Channel 1 over. This is Channel 1 over. This is the beginning of Channel 1 over.
I'd like to hear you talk just a little bit about the horse on the lunch line. They ought to hear just one.
Well, I don't know, just...
I never knew that.
Every young horse ought to start off on lunge. And every horse ought to be lunged. No, I'd lunge any horse.
Yeah.
But young horse, when they're just beginning, the whole idea is to get the horse to obey without frightening him. And so what he learned, the first thing he learns is voice commands. Mm-hmm. That's why there shouldn't be anybody talking or anything to a person who's lunging a horse. And they depend on it. I've watched a little baby that Celia was lunging, a little thoroughbred. And she was, you could see that she was listening for Celia's voice. But even more with one of the ponies, Judy worked with a pony backing it for the first time.
Oh.
And then she got one of the other girls to ride it for the first time, one of the children who was lighter. And it took a long time before that pony would listen to anyone except Judy's voice. And she would have to go into the school and just tell it to trot, walk, canter, so forth. And it would pay attention to her voice, and it took it a while. Then it had to gradually be weaned away from the voice, using the legs and the bit. But it was gradual, and until it was ready, all it heard was her voice. And it was funny because it wouldn't pay any attention to anybody else's voice. One of the, you know, the girl that was riding it would try to use the voice commands. And if Judy was in the school, the pony wouldn't pay any attention. But he'd been working with her for a couple of months. But Pussy is very sensitive to it. What happened yesterday, she was excited. She'd already worked herself up. And I turned and started to say something to Faye, and that set her off. She thought I was talking to her, and I said it in a bit of a loud voice. And
yeah.
She thought I was... She didn't know what to make of it. She didn't know whether she was supposed to go faster or slower, but she figured that she better go faster. And she just took off.
She did.
And ran. And she did that today with me twice, and she got away from me.
Today?
Mm-hmm. And all I was doing was clucking. And, you know, just going... And if she it would be just enough. It's supposed to be just a very light signal. I mean, if I really wanted her to go on, I would have said gallop or canter or something more forceful, a word, not just a cluck. But she knows she's supposed to go faster if I say that. And she was trotting around and she worked herself up. She'd already burst into a gallop a couple of times. And her trot began to get lazy. And I clucked to her a couple of times, and she took off, just dead run, and I couldn't hold on to her. She just hit the end of that lunge line tape and kept on going, and went over and stood under the tree, and I went out to her and picked up the lunge tape, wrapped it up, and led her back out, and started her off walking again. And this time I started trotting and I just talked to her low all the time. Something like, "You're a good girl, Pussy, you're doing fine, keep it slow, keep it slow." Then if I wanted her to go faster, I'd cluck to her, but I'd still keep talking. And she paid attention, and she settled down. She was listening, and she settled down, and then when I clucked to her, she would put in a little more energy. She began to get lazy, till when she quit, she had pretty good cadence. She was in time. In other words, she wouldn't go slow 1 minute, fast the next, which is what she had been doing. And when I finished with her, she was doing real well, but... And see, I didn't expect her to be that sensitive to the voice. And then yesterday, that was a bit of a...
Yeah.
But to be that sensitive, where you have to talk to her all the time just to keep her listening, keep her quiet, that just something like going, can set her off. No, I guess... I've never taught anybody to talk to an animal. Because you can do, usually that's by example. In other words, anybody seeing me handle a horse or listening to me handle a horse and train a horse would see how I talk to a horse, and that's how I picked it up, was listening to people talk to horses. Tell you the first thing you've got to, before you can talk to a horse or any other animal, you've got to be used to it. And they'll never, most of these kids just aren't used to being around a horse or a cow or any other animal.
Yeah.
They can talk to their dogs.
Can they?
Most of them can. See, the thing that happens, for instance, to somebody like Krista or Vivian, the moment when they should be talking to the horse, they're so worried about something else that's happening that they can't talk. They couldn't even talk to me, nevertheless, the horse. They can't even get the air out of their throats.
They need the horse to talk to them.
Yeah.
That's right.
They can't even get the air out of their lungs, nevertheless, talk. At the times when they really need to talk.
Well, they're on the horse. Of course, I am taking the point of view of a person on the ground,
just handling. Even so, it's the same. Because when you need to talk, of course, now you can walk up to a horse, and most of these kids can do that. They can walk up to a horse and say, "Hello, Hubert, are you doing well?" This sort of thing.
But they'll just do it once, but they won't talk. That's not what I call
They won't
talk.
Keep it up continuously. They do. Well, of course, unless I'm handling a horse, I don't do it continuously either. I only use my voice when I want it for a reason. In other words, or else I don't know whether it'd lose its effect or not, but I don't talk continuously to a horse. I talk to him when I'm doing something. But I don't just sit there and talk to him continuously. I pat him instead.
Did Debbie talk to the horse, please?
Pretty much. She didn't have Barbara's discipline for the horse. She was easy. She could get Missy to do and look. She knew what to do with him. Not like Barbara, but she knew the deal. She talked.
Flips her ears back and forth and cocks her eye over in my direction.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Put her on the left. Since I started again, she's not.
Uh-huh.
Not till she's going right on the right.
Yeah.
I figured I'd start her on the left tomorrow. Just tomorrow when I start her on the left. I'm expecting that. Off things to sink in. She's finally figured out about cantering. She doesn't always get a right lead, but at least she'll go on a signal to canter and not think that it just means a trot. And she'll go into a trot and not think that she's supposed to canter.
Well, that is a great accomplishment. If you can teach me what to do about it, it will be still greater.
Great accomplishment, yeah.
Well, first of all, you put on spurs.
All right. I'll put on anything just in order to get her into account without working at it.
Oh.
Well, the only horse out here that has spurs is Tony, I guess.
Johnny rode Pussy with spurs.
These aren't like Tony. They aren't like the ones they use on Tony. They aren't used the same way.
What's the difference?
I use what they call a Prince of Wales spur.
That's
an English spur.
That's the only pair of spurs we've got, the ones you picked up the other day.
All it's got is a little bar of metal about an inch and a half, 2 inches long, out from the heel. It's blunt. It's smooth. It's not sharp.
Yeah.
And all you do is touch the horse with it.
On the side you want her to take her lead.
On the side you want her to take her lead or whatever you're doing. The idea is, especially with me on Pussy, I can't get... She's not sensitive enough to the calf of my leg. And I can't get her with my... touch her with anything lower than just below my knee because I'm too big for her. My leg just goes right on down below her. And the only way I can touch her and make a clear signal is with the spurs.
My leg's going to be longer than yours, you see.
Yeah.
I think
I can shorten my stirrups, but I don't like to do that because it makes it more difficult to sit into that trot when she goes into it. And I have trouble enough with that.
Now, what was that you were saying about thoroughbreds? They would...
Well, a thoroughbred, when it's unhappy and confused, not always. Some of them are different, but... They're more likely to show nervousness. They got more ways of showing nervousness. And they'll stand there and tremble and roll their eyes and snort and their nostrils come red and they can break out into a sweat. Oh, it takes thoroughbred no time at all to break out into a sweat if it gets nervous.
Oh.
And, you know, it just stands there and gets wet, like Molly.
Well, it's not the work, it's just...
Oh, no, it's nerves. I've worked a horse into a lather standing still, just about.
The chap would do that.
Depending on the horse.
Yeah.
But one of the more nervous types. I could do it on purpose, but I wouldn't want to. But I have worked a horse into a sweat just walking around trying to get it to do something. Blotch, this crazy little horse I rode in England, would be perfectly calm, perfectly quiet, and I'd start working him on something like getting him to walk on. And accept the bit and begin to raise his head a little bit, get his hind legs under him a little bit and keep walking out and he'd get himself into a lather and he would worry and he wouldn't fight necessarily. It wasn't that much resistance. It would just, he'd worry about it and he could get himself hot and sweaty without ever going out of a walk. So I'd trot him or carry him to cool him off. Just let him stretch his legs a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Stretch out.
Yeah.
Wasn't that? It was, he could go into a free walk on long rein. But the idea was to get him to bring his hind legs under more. And what they call shortening the horse. And what he brings his head up and his hind legs underneath and his whole weight is carried back on the hind legs more. He can't just, he shifts how he carries his weight from the front feet to the hind feet. And it takes a horse a while to learn how to do that. And Blotch was lazy behind. Now, some horses just naturally use their hind legs. Pussy uses hers pretty well, considering, but she still goes pretty much on the forehand. But Molly doesn't use her hind legs at all. She just keeps her back completely stiff and hollow, and her hind legs hardly even look like they're moving. She barely uses them at all. There's no suppleness there.
Now that's that's heresy.
Well, no.
We didn't get into that.
I did a little bit. I said Nick, Barbara was trying to get Molly out of some of her stiffness. He said, "What stiffness?" I said, "Well, you know, I fussed about this lope of hers, that I couldn't ride on a lope, and you even pulled her into a short one so that you thought maybe it would be a little more comfortable." No, I didn't.
No, don't you know it's because he won't let a horse canter out any faster than that?
I said...
Because what, Mama?
He says he doesn't like a horse to lope any faster than that.
That's what he told me. He said, "You know, a horse has got to lope slowly." And that's why I worked her that way. I said, "Well, you know her back legs are stiff, Nick." "No. No. There's not anything stiff about Molly."
Oh, poor old stiff neck, stiff back Molly. Oh, well.
You know what you did this morning at noon? When was that, Faye? At breakfast. She just held, been holding out on us again. She just clear introduced two brand
new characters. New
you
people.
Did.
I know.
Now you got them. Gotta introduce us to them, really.
And they are above Miss Parker. Although
oh, yes. Oh,
I
yes.
thought Miss Parker was sort of managerial.
Well, Miss Parker was the cook and clean, did the rooms down at the stable. Now, Vashie and Mrs. Thornett had been Mrs. Tilk's dailies. And they helped her at the house. And besides that, they were village women, and the Parkers were fly-by-nights.
2 years?
2 years. That's all they stayed.
Now, he was a little... Unstable.
Well, he came. He was supposed to do the work, the handyman sort of work around the stable, light short jobs, and that lasted about 6 months. And they were given the cottage, which was a little cottage up on one of the corner of the property that had been built. When the new road came through, there used to be an inn, an old coaching inn, on the Mrs. Tilk's. That property apparently was Mrs. Tilk's before they married. And when the road went through, they tore down the inn, and Mrs. Tilk said that she would not fight it if they would give her the materials from this old inn, 1700, something like that. So she built this cottage out of all those materials. It's completely, everything in it is 18th century or 17th century. I forget how old the inn was. And the people, the caretaker they'd had in it before had kept a beautiful garden. And it just kept it up so well. And they rented it to the Parkers and on the condition they would keep the cottage up. And he was going to be handyman for the stable and she was to be cook. This is typical caretaker and wife cook thing.
Fine arrangement.
You know, it's one very common arrangement. But he very quickly developed rheumatism, arthritis, and everything else that could cripple him up and keep him at home. Because the cottage went into a complete state of disrepair, and the garden was let go to rack and ruin, and let me have my blanket, please. And Mrs. Parker stayed on. She kept on doing her work as cook. But it turned really, before the 6 months were out, it was already a very unsatisfactory working deal. But Miss Bashy had been Mrs. Tilt's dame for 20 years when she retired, because she remembered when Celia was a baby, and she had been the daily all through those kids' childhood, and she came in once a week. She had retired, more or less. So she only came once a week. And she was a bright, bright spirit. She really was. She'd come down the hall with her mop bucket and her mops and Mrs. Thornett trailing behind her. And she'd see me darting into my room to make up bed fast before she got in there. And she'd turn around and she'd say, "Mr. Parker, we've caught them this time. We've caught them this time." And she always had something bright to say. Miss Thornett depended. She was usually in a good humor when Bashy was there, because then she had only half as much work to do. And that always put her in a good humor. But she could be sour sometimes. She'd look in the room and say, "Y'all didn't do a very good job today, did you?" They came down to do the rooms once a week. And they never could find any of the stuff they had to do it with. The pair of them would come into the club room. And they'd look around the club room and Bashy would say, "Well, you certainly managed to get this straight in time," or whichever way it went. And about that time, Mrs. Thornett would come in from the hall and she'd say, where's the dustpan, or where's the broom, or where's this, that, or the other, because it was never where it was supposed to be. And they'd go on about cleaning the rooms. All they did really was to run into them and make sure that the basins were clean. And they weren't servants. And you better not give them any orders.
They weren't servants.
Well, no, not in the sense of, you know, that sort of daily help can be. They didn't take orders from anybody. And somebody had the nerve to give Bashy an order. In front of Bashy and Miss Thornett. And they were furious. They were absolutely furious. And I know who it was. It was another person you hadn't met. Mr. Perkins. the man I did not dealings with my car with. One day he came down, and he was looking for me, and he saw Vashi and Miss Thornet getting ready to go out and start on the room. And he said, he walked up to him and said, is Barbara around? And I said, well, yes, but I'm not sure where she is. Well, could you find her for me, please? And there was something about the tone of voice that he said it in. And that just set their backs up, right there. And he came, he saw me, and what he wanted to see me about was about, he hadn't been able to find me a car, and I'd been pushing him about it because he had said he would, and I was in the middle of my vacation. I had come back down to see about some insurance on his car that he'd loaned me. And he got pretty nasty about it. He said that he was talking about how the rent on the car that he had loaned me would have been so many pounds, and he thought I was getting an awfully good deal to be loaned this car. And I was having my vacation, wasn't I? And said, yes, but I didn't ask for the loan of the car. And he says, well, I'm trying my best to find a car for you. I've got two I want you to come look at, and all this sort of stuff. And I said, you know, just, I wasn't interested. I knew what he had to come, wanted me to go look at. And so after he left, Bashy, his son says, Barbara, how can you take it? He was so doggone rude to you. Well, I didn't think he wasn't, really. But he'd gotten their backs up because he told one of them to come look for me. And he had no quarter with them. He was the rudest, most uncouth person they decided they'd seen in a long time. And they went up. The poor man almost lost his job.
Oh.
Darn near did lose his job. They went up to Mr. Till, gave a big, highly colorful account what had gone on. And Mr. Tilt came down and said, look, I'll go up and talk to Mr. Pashler, who owns the place. See, I was dealing through the neighborhood, the little garage up the hill. And Mr. Tilt went up there and talked to Mr. Pashler. And Mr. Pashler told Mr. Perkins he either found the car for me or loaned me his car again, or he was fired. And Bashy and Mrs. Thornet were highly satisfied. They hoped he'd lost his job. He didn't. He was too smooth an operator to lose his job or something like that. Yeah, they knew what they were to do. They worked with Mrs. Tilt, and see, Bashy had been working with Mrs. Tilt for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And Miss Thornet for almost five, over five. And Mrs. Tilt never gave them orders in the sense of a boss giving a workers orders. When I saw her, whenever she said anything to him, it was, well, we'll do this. Or if you'll do this, well, I'll go do something else.
Oh, that kind.
That kind, you see. And it was never, the atmosphere was sort of what working together. She was never condescending. She never acted as if hired help were any different. Or anything to be, you know, anything she wouldn't do if she weren't doing the hiring.
You know, Mr. Potter talks,
Perkins?
Mr. Patterson talks about these people who worked for him for 20 years. And Ms. Patterson, the people who cook for him all for 20 years, things like that.
That's all seems so phenomenal to me that they can have an establishment that long and just keep going day after day.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Siga would have been very upset if anybody had ever insulted Bashy. Because she said that she told us that Bashy was part of the family. Well, see, she started working for her as daily, weekly help when Mrs. Parker left. Bashy said she'd come back one day a week. And when we found out that Bashy was coming back, well, Celia, you know, told us and said, now Bashy, you'll love her. She's just as much fun as she can be, and she's been with our family for 20 years, and she is part of it.
Well, now, was she good fun, and did you love her?
Oh, yeah, Bashy was good fun. We never had any run-ins with Bashy. She only came once a week. And it was after Mrs. Parker left, which made a difference in a lot of things. And she would tease us about how the club went, what sort of condition the club room was in. See, we were supposed to keep it clean and all that sort of stuff. And she was always willing to have a chat and have a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Laugh about something and was with you. And she and Mrs. Thornett, some days they'd come down and they were just as gleeful and laughing.
Oh.
Go down, you hear them in the passage, just laughing away about something. And,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Why would we see you laugh? Why?
Mrs. Batchelor.
Oh, I see.
Bashy.
Just
well, you couldn't expect Judy and Celia to say Mrs. Batchelor when they were 5 years old.
Oh, so they call her Bashy.
They call her Bashy.
Well, now, we haven't seen them.
Thornett was... I guess she was about my height. And... really very heavy built and hefty and square face with dark hair that's just beginning to get streaked with gray. And most of the time when either one of them spoke to you, it was the tease. Because, you see, they didn't have much dealings with us on a business sort of point, except when Mrs. Thornett would get upset about where the where the broom was. And she usually wore a cardigan, an apron, and those heavy shoes.
Oh.
And, she'd come in looking for the broom. And she'd look kind of cross. Have you seen the broom? No, I haven't seen it. Well, I really think that it must be around here someplace. And I can't understand what you all do with these things. And then there was the mop. They brought down a sponge, one of those foam mops to use for tile floors and so forth. Because they'd just put in some new linoleum in the gallery, and it was not supposed to get wet. It was just supposed to be damp mopped, not wet mopped. And it somebody made a mistake and used it on wood or concrete or something, and it disintegrated. And for a couple of weeks, Miss Thornett would come down and she'd bring it out of the cupboard and she'd say, "Look at this. What do you do with it? Somebody must use it on wood. It's not supposed to be used on wood. Well, get her along. Miss Bashy would say, well, maybe they used it to scrub the passageways in front of the stalls. Bashy had such good humor. And Bashy was older and thinner, and but just looked just as red-cheeked and bright. And she moved quickly. Mrs. Thornett didn't move particularly quickly. Bashy did everything quickly. And she looked at Judy and C.U. with a nurse's eye. You know, a nursery nurse, not a doctor's nurse. And she'd look at him and she'd say, you know, I was here when they were little children. I can remember that Judy was never down at the stable. She was always up at the house because as a punishment for doing something wrong, they'd be sent up to the house. And Judy was always at the house. And Judy would laugh and say, yes, that's why I can't ride as well as see. I never was allowed down at the stable.
Now look, Barbara, the young people, their children, don't want to be like them. But I wouldn't want to be like the young people. I'd rather be like Ms. Bashy. Yeah. I don't know why. It looks to me like that's just a great world of their own that they have lived in. Just marvelous. And wouldn't want to give it up. Well, of course, they don't give it up.
They don't.
No.
18-year-old came there when she was 17 to on the same course we were on,
yeah.
But the year before I went.
Yeah.
And when she first went there, she couldn't. She was bossing it over us so badly that we decided to go and look at the book. Because somebody had told us that there was a clue there that would help us. I don't know who. But somebody out of curiosity was looking at the year before his book. And at the very beginning of the year, when Elaine first came, there were listed things like lecture for Elaine on how to groom a horse, lecture for Elaine on how to lead a horse, lecture for Elaine on... She was hopeless. And they had a month trial period. And after the end of the month, if the person doesn't measure up, they send them home, or vice versa, they can leave. After that, you're considered under contract. And they planned to send her home at the end of the month. But somehow they decided not to. And she improved, but she could still make the most outlandish mistakes, just not thinking. Because and she'd do it when she was trying to impress somebody. I think her best one, one of the funniest was the day we cleaned out the tack room. We spring cleaned the tack room in the middle of January. This was, she'd just gotten her AI, and she was really feeling it. And she came in and she said, you're all to meet me in the office at such and such time. Oh, go, here it comes again. This was, she had a lovely talent for things like this. Things like sitting in the office and calling to you as you went by and insisting that you come in and stand right in front of her before she would talk to you. before she would tell you what she wanted, and it might be just to go into the other room and get her something that she could doggone well have gone and gotten herself. And this is the thing, this is the sort of thing we resented most of all. And it got so that I would just keep on walking. I never heard a word she said. I'd done that before. And then once I told her she could get up and come tell me. Well, you can't take too much of that. Not from any little 18-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, how did she happen to get on the staff?
Mystery. Big question mark. I don't know. Except that they needed the extra help and they couldn't find anybody. But, at any rate, after this, she called us into the office, gave us orders to be there at such and such time, and we went to see you and see if you had to be there. And, so we trooped in and she said, "We're going to spring clean the tech room." And we pointed out to her that it was below freezing and that it was the middle of winter and not spring, but that didn't make a whole big lot of impression. And we had to take out all the trunks, wash the tack room floor, scrub all the windows, wash down the walls. It was the most ridiculous thing. Celia was in her room in hysterics laughing about it. We finally got in the humor of it. We glared Elaine every time she went past, but we were laughing ourselves sick over it too. And Mr. Tilt came by and he picked his way through the trunks because they were all in the passageway, were in the way. And he stopped and he looked into the tack room. And he looked at us, and he sort of winked and smiled and went on by. Oh, and he gave his one expression, "Go." Go. And we had to take it, but she was, "Meet me in the taxi." You are to be in the tack room at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, 9 o'clock.
We will spring clean the tack room. In the middle of January.
18 years old.
Mm. Oh, she was proud. And she got crushed a few times. And she would be all humble and nice, and we could live with her for another month or so. And then something would happen that'd blow her ego up again, and we'd have to think of something to stop it. I'm afraid we were really rather not nearly as bad as when she first came. They were really cruel to her. They'd snub her every time she tried to make a move because she was so overbearing. And she was tall, one of these tall, gangly girls that can look like, she held her head and looked down her nose. And she had, her speech was what the proper English that's taught in schools, that every other Englishman knows is an affectation.
Mm-hmm.
And Judy and Jane, with us, you know, we'd be talking or something, and they'd say, "Well, now, Barbara, I know you can't tell this, but if you knew anything about, you know, English, you could tell that Elaine, the speech Elaine uses is not what her parents speak, or what she was raised to speak."
Mm-hmm.
And that counted against her terribly, that she wouldn't stay in her proper place.
Mm-hmm.
And speak as she was born to speak. She would have been much more, she would have been accepted, even being overbearing, she would have been a lot more accepted if she had not tried to be so terribly, terribly snooty. But the worst thing she did was besides just being sort of lazy and getting everybody, ordering everybody else to do her work for her,
One time she got James. Well, she was in charge of the feed room. She was supposed to keep it clean. She was supposed to take all the old feed sacks and pile them up, tie them up with string, and put them up in the loft till they could be burned. And for about a stretch of about 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, we'd hear this horrible yell down the yard, Jane! And it was just like that. It was unbelievable. And Jane would say, look up to heaven, and she'd say, here it comes. She'd finally condescend, look out the tack room door. Yes. Go down to the feed room and tie up the sacks and throw them in the loft. I've got to lunge Timothy. So Jane would go down and tie up the feed sacks and put them in the loft and do anything else that she was told to do down there, because Jane was not the sort of person to fight back. So Anne, a little Canadian girl who was feisty as she could be, decided she'd had enough. And Elaine yelled for Jane to go down and tie up the feed sacks, and Anne said, she's not coming! You can do it yourself! And that's all it took with Elaine. It never took more than one stop to put her in her place. If you were bold enough, just go ahead and do it. And Anne would. Anne was terrible. She never gonna let anybody step on her. And then she was doing pretty well. And just before we left, I don't know what happened, but she didn't like one of the clients. He was a young man who was her perfect partner, if she'd only realized it. The same sort of family background, with the same sort of education, the same affectations of speech, and the same overbearing, haughty manner. And she detested it. And she, for the same reasons that the others found her objectionable, only she never realized it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul Cunningham used to come in, and he would talk about this job he had in America. He'd started writing. What was so sickening about it was he was so doggone good. He'd started writing when he was the summer or something like that, before he first started coming to Tilt, with a riding book on the post and a horse. And he was sickeningly good.
Hmm.
But he was rough. Just rough. Anytime the horse didn't do what he wanted it to do, while he was there with whip and spur to make it do what he wanted it to do. And one time he came into the school and he was going to teach one of our fine old campaigners, our old horses that we all loved, to turn or something like that. And to get him to turn. Now this horse knew everything. 3 times as much as Paul Cunningham ever had in his head. And he started turning it around, and he didn't turn fast enough, so he was using his stick to shoo the horse on around. And I turned to him and said, Paul, what do you think you're doing? That horse knows more about that than you do. And he'd stutter around a little bit. I delighted in dropping on Paul Cunningham. I would feel guilty about tromping on Elaine, because Elaine I never felt was quite fair to tromp on, because she was so, I don't know. But Paul asked for it, and I just delighted in tromping on him every chance I could get. But anyway, he was in a lesson, and Elaine was out to show him, to impress him. And they went out, and see, he just bought a horse. This horse was supposed to do him for the hunt season. Came in with the cough, they call it, equine influenza. There had been an epidemic of it, and we had managed not to have a single case, and he brought this horse in, and it had. And he was talking big bold about how he was going to come to the United States. He had got a job over here riding show jumpers. And I laughed and laughed and laughed. And says, "You think you're just going to go over there and clean up?" And he says, "Yes." Boy, you got a lot to learn. And he was going to come over in September. And in October, he drove up with his horse. "When are you going to the States?" "Well, I guess I won't go until January. They've got some sort of flu or other over there, and I don't think I'll go until January. Some sort of bug." So he started his riding lessons again. He quit, saved up money to go. And he started his riding lessons again, and Elaine had him for a lesson. And he'd been bragging, talking about hunting this horse, you see, and his great show jumping he was going to do. And admittedly, there was a strong urge on everybody's part to have him come a cropper at some job, just to the light and see him fall off. But she took him, and it was about dusk, and they'd been working in school while it was light. And just at dusk, you know, when it's so difficult to see, she took him out and started working on the cross-country course. And she ended up on top of the hill, jumping dark jumps that the horses could not see. And Paul Cunningham got frightened, all right, but he had reason to. He said, we were jumping jumps. I couldn't see them. I know my horse couldn't see them. And I was furious. And I was all set to really give it to her when she came in the club room. And somebody said, "Well, see, you know." And somebody else said, "No, she doesn't know she was actually jumping. I was there." She walked past and said, just as they were going out, and see, you said, "You aren't going to be doing jumping, are you?" And Lane looked kind of smug. And I thought, well, if see, you know something about it, I can't say anything. I mean, if Celia knew and had told, was going to tell off Elaine for it, I wasn't going to be the first to jump on her. So I didn't say anything. I thought some deep comments later, though. Like starting a conversation on how horses are colorblind and can't see in twilight. That would have been lovely, but I missed it. Mm-hmm. But, a horrible, terrible streak in me.
I know where you got it.
Well, Elaine, we waited because Celia found out about it. Celia told her father, and her father was furious. So we waited to hear about the great blowout between Mr. Tilk and Elaine. And it never came. And I mentioned it to somebody and said, Oh, didn't you know? Elaine went up there to ask Mr. Tilk how long he thought it would be before she would be able to take her eye exam, which you can't take until you're over 21. She was 18. You're not supposed to be able to take it till you're over 21 and have worked at least a year in a stable, and you have to know oh so much, just about every branch of equitation. And just the book work alone would have stymied Elaine, nevertheless, the practical part of it. But, and she, the beautiful mistakes she made in the practical part, and she didn't stand much chance. And she'd gone up to ask Mr. Tilk how long he thought it would be before she passed her eye. She said, you know what he told her. He told her that she not only didn't stand a chance of passing her eye, that she didn't watch out, she wasn't going to be here much longer. And he went through a whole list of things that she had done. I thought she'd been acting like a student for about a week there.
What do you think he read them off to her?
He would, yes.
How do you do that?
Well, I shouldn't say exactly, but a little bit from the dressing down I had heard, I imagine he just went straight through. You've done this, this, and this. And if you don't straighten up and learn and begin to use your brain and think about these things, you'll have to I can't sort of give him words.
He's pretty firm?
Oh, very firm.
You've heard him be firm?
I've heard him be firm, yes. Not only just on that night when he was after us. See, occasionally he would get that way in a lesson. He thought somebody was, usually with somebody good, like Michael. He has a very fine three day event horse, and Mr. Tilt would occasionally get firm with him about the way he was riding. But it's usually such a momentary thing, sort of a flash, and then it's gone. Like you must get to do this with your horse. You must do it. And occasionally he would actually shout, very rarely. If he shouted, you knew you were in trouble. And the one time I really saw him shout at somebody was at Elaine. We were riding, and Lord knows what she had her mind on. But she was riding as leading file. And she'd just come back from a holiday. And Mr. Tilt would give an order, like change the rein, or divide the ride at letter C, first to the right, second to the left, and Elaine would go be the first one and go off to the left, or she wouldn't change the rein, or she'd trot when they were supposed to canter. And, oh, he got furious. And he really yelled. He said, Elaine, if you can't straighten up, you can get out. Just because you've been on a vacation, you've no sense in not doing what you're told. She almost straightened up, almost. But he was sharp that time. That's as sharp as I ever heard him.
Well, now, Mr. Tilt just knew everything. And he just carried it around with him.
Well, yeah. About horses.
Now, that's the end of this talk. Channel 1 over, a variety of subjects. Channel 1 over, the end of Channel 1 over, a variety of subjects. The end of this talk. And that was Monday after supper, because we'd look forward to it all day. Barbara had mentioned the two women, the Dailies, at breakfast. There was no time to go into them then. And I remember I'd look forward to them all day on Monday the 1st of December, 69. Monday the 1st of December, 69. And this is the end of Channel 1 Over. And that talk after supper on Monday the 1st of December, 69. The end of the talk on Monday the 1st of December, 69. And over towards the end of Channel 1 Over. There's still about 100 left on Channel 1 Over.